I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels family of 22 brands has over 7,400 locations and the perfect hotel for any traveler you want to be. Like a Cambria Hotel, serving up locally inspired craft cocktails for all my folks who maybe want to meet up and talk about Mad Royals. Check into a Radisson Hotel with flexible workspaces for you strivers who listen during business travel. Or a Comfort Hotel with free hot breakfast, family-friendly pools, and big spacious rooms for the parents who listen with their kids and need a little retreat. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you when you book direct at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Tracy V. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
We mentioned this in a listener mail segment not long ago, but we did finally take that trip to Italy that we originally planned all the way back in 2019 and then had to postpone repeatedly because of the COVID-19 pandemic. So the trip was to Rome and parts of Tuscany, and then I stayed a few extra days to go to Venice, and of course, through all of that, saw all kinds of things that could become podcast episodes. One of them was in the Doge's Palace in Venice, which was both the Doge's residence and the seat of the Venetian government until the fall of the Venetian Republic in 1797. So in that palace, the Chamber of the Great Council is the largest chamber. It's built to accommodate a council that sometimes had more than 2,000 members, and it's just a truly striking room. A lot of the rooms in the palace are, apart from its size, which is very large, the walls and the ceiling are adorned with artwork depicting scenes from Venetian history and allegorical representations of the Republic. And then all around the room, in a row, just below the ceiling, are portraits of 76 doges. Each of them has a banner noting what his major accomplishments were, except for one. The 55th Doge of Venice is instead represented by a black banner that says in Latin, "Here is the place of Marino Faliero, decapitated for his crimes." So the audio tour that we were listening to said he had been executed for treason. So, of course, I had to find out what's that story there.
And we're going to start with just a bit of background about the Republic of Venice and how the office of Doge evolved. Although people had settled already on various islands in the northwestern Adriatic Sea, what we know as Venice today started to coalesce around the end of the 7th century. Early on, the ruler of Venice was known by the Latin title Dux, that's D-U-X, which eventually morphed into Doge, which was used in Venice and some other parts of what's now Italy.
Yeah, and in Italian, that final E is pronounced a little bit more, but in English, we say it Doge. Sometimes Doge is translated as Duke. That also traces back to that same Latin origin. But in most places, Duke is a hereditary title. And although there were some attempts early on to make the office of Doge a hereditary one, in the end, in Venice, it explicitly was not.
Historically, dukes have also been sovereign rulers of duchies, which was also a different setup from the role of Doge. The first Doge of Venice is generally recognized as Paolo Lucio Anafesto, who was elected in the year 697. But at that point, Venice was not a sovereign nation. It was part of the Eastern Roman Empire, under the command of the Exarch of Ravenna. Under the Eastern Roman Empire, the office of Doge started out primarily as a military role.
Even as the role of Doge expanded out beyond something involving mostly military stuff, there was still some power wrangling going on between Venice and the Byzantine Empire. So, for example, in the 8th century, Emperor Leo III banned the use of religious icons and ordered their destruction. This policy of iconoclasm was deeply controversial, and it was reviled by many of the Venetian clergy. So the clergy elected their own doge, Orso Appato. Sometimes he's described as the first true doge of Venice because he was the first one to be elected without the Byzantine Empire's involvement. But Leo did not recognize Venice as independent after this election. He offered the doge the Byzantine title of Hippatos, which he accepted, so that made him at least nominally part of the imperial court, not just doge on his own, off by himself.
These sorts of power struggles continued until the late 9th century, when Venice established itself as an independent republic, governed by a popularly elected doge, although its relationship with the Byzantine Empire was often fraught. From there, Venice quickly grew into a major maritime power. In many ways, it had to be. Almost every basic necessity had to be brought in from elsewhere. Venice used its maritime power to conquer additional territory and as leverage when negotiating trading agreements with other nations and empires. By the 11th century, Venice had become a major trading center, moving huge amounts of things like luxury goods, spices, wood, and precious metals. Although at some points, slavery and slave trading were banned under Venetian law, Venice also participated in slave trafficking, and there were enslaved workers within the Venetian Republic.
During this approximate period, the office of Doge had become incredibly powerful. But in the late 12th century, the Venetian government started formally trying to limit that power. The process of electing a new doge shifted from a popular vote to a nomination process that was carried out only among the ducal counselors. The government also started delegating the doge's decision-making power to other government bodies. So there was the Great Council, which had sometimes as many as 2,000 members. The doge effectively reported to the minor council, which was made up of 6 ducal counselors. They kind of oversaw all of his decisions. Then there was the Council of 40, or Quarantina, which acted as a supreme court. In addition to limiting the doge's power, these changes also put more power into the hands of the Venetian nobility.
By this point, Venice was extremely wealthy, powerful, and renowned for its shipbuilding, both for the quality of the ships themselves and the speed at which they could be built. In the 12th century, Venice built a fleet for the Fourth Crusade, which is, of course, its own entire story. But briefly, Pope Innocent III called for this crusade to try to bring Jerusalem under Christian control. French and German forces were supposed to meet in Venice, bringing the money with them to pay for the fleet. But many departed from their own ports instead. Doge Enrico Dandolo persuaded the crusaders to settle this debt by attacking the Catholic city of Zara, which had been part of the Republic before rebelling in 1186. The Fourth Crusade then went on to capture the city of Constantinople, and Thomas Morosini of Venice became the first Latin patriarch of Constantinople.
Although this really expanded Venice's power and wealth and influence, Venice itself was becoming increasingly divided. Political power had become really concentrated into a small group of noble families, and most of those families had a long history in Venice. But Venice had also become home to an increasingly wealthy class of merchants and artisans, and many of them were newcomers to the area. They were pushing for their own representation and involvement in the government. This class became known as the Popolo, and the Venetian government worked to try to curtail their influence. So they did things like kept the trade guilds divided from one another so that the more wealthy tradespeople couldn't easily come together and push for change.
And as the Popolo tried to find a way into the Venetian government, the nobility locked down its power. Membership in the major council eventually became hereditary by law, limiting members to men from fewer than 200 families.
Just to be clear here, even though Popolo means people, this was still a pretty specific and limited group of Venetian people who were trying to get a place in the government. This was about skilled tradespeople and artisans and merchants and other people who had amassed some wealth. So they were not really including poor people or laborers or enslaved people in all of this.
Meanwhile, the office of Doge was becoming less and less powerful. Enrico Dandolo had been the first to swear a promissione ducale, or oath of office, that formally and publicly outlined his power. A committee revised that oath for each incoming doge, sometimes tailoring it in response to actions taken by the previous doge.
In the face of all this, the early 14th century saw a wave of popular uprisings and conspiracies in Venice as people tried to get the major council to open up new members and generally just tried to have a bigger voice in the government. This included an attempt to overthrow the doge in 1310. After that, the Venetian government established the Council of Ten, which was an elected body, again, elected within that group of nobility, whose duties included things like maintaining a secret police and investigating suspected conspiracies and treason.
To add to all of that, Venice was at war with Genoa, part of a series of wars that stretched from 1256 to 1381. In the first half of the 14th century, Venice also faced a series of earthquakes and the Black Death, which killed as much as a third of the Venetian population.
All of this that we've been talking about was going on just before Marino Faliero's election as Doge. We'll get to that after a quick sponsor break. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Thank you.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about Comfort Hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
Marino Faliero was born in Venice, and various sources give his birth year as 1274, 1279, and 1285. You'll also see his name spelled in a few different ways. Today, when I was doing the research for this, I saw it most often as Marino Faliero, but in Venetian dialect, it was Marine Falier. The Latin inscription that we mentioned up at the top of the show used the name Malini Faletri. However the name is spelled, though, this was a prominent family. They had a long history in Venice, including other doges in the family. Vitale Faliero was the 32nd doge from 1084 to 1095. And then, as we said, this office was not hereditary, but different people in the same family could be elected. And Vitale's son, Ordelafo, was elected to be the 34th doge and was in office from 1102 to 1117.
Marino Faliero married twice, first to Tomasina Contarini, and then after her death to Alucia Gradenigo. Although we do not have much information about either of them, they were both from prestigious families. Alucia was much younger than Marino when they married, but she was still probably in her 40s. Some fictionalized depictions of all of this depict Alucia as extremely young, pretty, and unfaithful, but there's really not much to back that up in the historical record.
Marino Faliero had a mostly distinguished career before being elected doge, including commanding Venice's fleet in the Black Sea. In addition to that, he was elected to the Council of Ten at various points, starting in 1315. He served as provincial governor of both Chioggi and Treviso. Chioggi is in the south of Venice on the Adriatic Sea, and Treviso is north of Venice and a little bit farther inland. He was also named Count of Valdemarino in the Marches of Treviso, and in 1353, he was knighted by Holy Roman Emperor Charles IV in Vienna.
In addition to all of that, Faliero served as a diplomat. For much of the 14th century, the papacy was headquartered in Avignon rather than in Rome, and Faliero traveled to Avignon at various points to negotiate with the Pope on behalf of Venice. On one diplomatic mission, he negotiated for Venice to be allowed to trade with Muslim ports in Egypt and Syria, something the Pope agreed to, providing that Venice's exports did not include iron, ship timbers, or enslaved people. When Faliero was elected doge, he was again in Avignon, petitioning for the Pope to intervene in Venice's ongoing war with Genoa.
It seems like Faliero was pretty well respected in all of these roles, but he was also reported to have a quick and sometimes even violent temper. This included slapping a bishop who was late bringing the sacrament to an official event. Marin Sanudo the Younger, who lived about two centuries after Faliero and wrote a book called The Lives of the Doges, said that he read about this in an earlier chronicle. He described it this way, quote, Marino Faliero was so very proud and wrathful that he buffeted the bishop and almost struck him to the ground.
As we said earlier, when Faliero was elected doge, he was in Avignon petitioning for the Pope to intervene in Venice's war with Genoa. Venice had won a series of critical battles, leading Genoa to sign a treaty with Milan for its own protection. the Archbishop of Milan sent poet and intellectual Francesco Petrarca, better known as Petrarch, to negotiate a peace with Venice. Petrarch was friends with the current doge, Andrea Dandolo, but since it looked like Venice was winning the war, Dandolo refused to negotiate.
This did not work out well for Dandolo. Naval forces from Genoa and Milan made their way into the Adriatic Sea, attacking Venetian ports and getting perilously close to Venice proper. It was at that point that the doge became personally involved in the fighting, and he contracted an illness and died.
The Great Council seems to have thought Faliero was the perfect choice for Dandolo's successor. That was thanks to his experience as both a diplomat and as a naval commander. The election of doge was carried out among 41 men, and 35 of them voted for Faliero on September 11, 1354.
After that election, the Great Council sent a delegation of 12 men to Avignon to inform Faliero of his election and to make sure he had safe passage back to Venice, because again, this war was still going on. Faliero got back to Venice in October, and there's some superstition surrounding his arrival. Normally, an official barge would formally dock alongside the doge's palace, but a thick fog surrounded the city that day, and it made that tradition unsafe. So Faliero had to be rowed to shore aboard a smaller tender.
And that tender missed the normal docking place and wound up at a spot just to the west of the palace called the Molo. There are two pillars at this spot marking the entrance to the piazzetta, or the little plaza, adjacent to the larger plaza of St. Mark. Those still stand today, one topped with the winged lion of St. Mark and the other with St. Theodore standing on a crocodile. Executions were sometimes carried out between those two pillars, so a lot of people thought it was bad luck to walk between them. But Faliero did that.
Again, in the words of Marine Snuto the Younger, quote, Messer Marino Faliero the Duke was about to land in this city on the fifth day of October 1354. A thick haze came on and darkened the air, and he was enforced to land on the place of St. Mark between the two columns on the spot where evildoers are put to death, and all thought that this was the worst of tokens.
Faliero's predecessor had been popular as doge, at least until the war shifted in the weeks just before his death. This is impressive, considering that his time as doge included a devastating earthquake and the Black Death. In spite of all the restrictions on his office, Andrea Dandolo had managed to reform the Venetian legal code and to write a history of Venice. Faliero may have hoped for a legacy that was equally impressive, but the revised oath of office he was given didn't leave him much autonomy at all. He couldn't even receive returning diplomats without counselors and members of the Quarantina there to observe.
In early November of 1354, Venice was defeated at the Battle of Sapienza, also called the Battle of Porto Longo. This was a catastrophic and humiliating loss, with Venice losing at least 30 ships and 5,000 men being killed or taken prisoner. Although the shipyards of Venice could build new ships at just an astounding rate, this wasn't a loss that could easily be recovered from. Faliero had no choice but to sign a peace treaty with Genoa a few months later.
This, of course, led to a lot of bitterness. The animosity between Venice and Genoa was deep, and it had been going on for decades. Plus, the defeat at Sapienza had followed some serious tactical errors on Venice's part. So people started to question Faliero's decision-making and that of the nobles who had been in command during the battle.
Faliero seems to have tried to mediate between the established leadership of the nobility and the increasingly discontented popolo. He commissioned new ships, and he put them under the command of some commoners who had distinguished themselves at sea. While this made some of the popolo happy, the nobility, of course, saw it as a threat. There were also ongoing disputes between the older members of the Council of 40 and the younger ones, who the older members saw as rude and brazen.
All of this seems to have fed into a conspiracy, and we're going to get into that after we pause for a sponsor break.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Is your underwear in need of a refresh? Meet Tomboy X, makers of the original boxer briefs for women, queer-founded and queer-run. Tomboy X designs sustainable, gender-inclusive underwear and apparel in sizes 3 extra small to 6 extra large. Use code IHEART at checkout for 20% off your first purchase only at TomboyX.com. Shop now on TomboyX.com.
Planning your next trip? Choice Hotels has a stay for any traveler you want to be, with 22 brands and over 7,400 locations. Whether you're a business traveler, a family road tripper, someone who wants to seek out history and maybe make your own, or just planning a quick getaway, Choice Hotels has a stay for any you. Like a Cambria Hotel, where you can be a cocktail connoisseur and sip locally inspired craft beverages at downtown locations in the center of it all. This is a fun way to visit cities with a lot of history and a lot of fun in mind. Or a Radisson Hotel, for all our productivity powerhouses out there. With flexible workspaces and on-site restaurants, you'll get the most out of your work trip. You'll get the coffee, the Wi-Fi, and the work done. And we can't forget about comfort hotels. Imagine you're a family road tripper waking up in your big spacious room and then heading down to a free hot breakfast for the entire family, including waffles. So you'll be well-fed and ready for the day's adventure, even if that's just relaxing. After that, you're spending all afternoon relaxing by the pool. You deserve it. What are you waiting for? Join Choice Privileges and start earning points toward your next stay. Find a stay for any you. Book directly at choicehotels.com, where travels come true.
All of those tensions between the nobility and the popolo seem to have come to a head in early 1355. The festival of Carnival just before Lent included things like bullfighting and mask balls. It's not clear whether it was actually called Carnival yet, but it was what evolved into that celebration. So during a banquet that the Doge hosted at the palace, a young noble named Michele Steno behaved indiscreetly with a woman. In some accounts, this woman was Faliero's wife, but most likely it was really with a young woman who was one of the Dogeress's attendants. It's possible that it was Christina Faliero, who was the wife of the Doge's nephew. That nephew was also named Marino Faliero, so if that's the case, it would explain some of this confusion. Whatever Steno did, the Doge found it offensive enough that he had him removed from the palace.
Of course, Steno was also insulted, and after everyone had left, he got back into the palace and scrawled some graffiti on the Doge's chair in the council room. Exactly what he wrote doesn't show up in accounts until much later, but it is usually noted as something like, Marin Faliero, the husband of the fair wife, others kiss her, but he keeps her.
So Faliero, having found this, ordered the Arsenalati to investigate. These were workers from Venice's shipyard and arsenal who also acted as the Doge's personal bodyguard. and they determined that Steno had written this graffiti, and he was brought before the Council of 40 to stand trial. The council felt like he was young and in love, and they were lenient with him since all of this was also happening during Carnival. He was to be, quote, kept in close confinement or imprisoned for 2 months, and then afterward he would be banished from Venice for a year. Faliero, though, did not think this was nearly enough. He wanted Steno to be hanged or banished for life for writing some graffiti.
Right. Writing some graffiti and possibly taking some liberties.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, these tensions between young nobles and old and between commoners and nobility were playing out in other parts of Venice as well. A commoner named Bertucci Isarello had been placed in command of a Venetian ship, and he got into a dispute with Giovanni Dandolo, paymaster of the Venetian Navy and a member of the same family that had produced the previous doge, as well as three others. And during this dispute, Dandolo reportedly slapped Isarello in the face. And another man named Gisello, who was a foreman at the arsenal, had also been slapped by great council member Marco Barbaro, who had been wearing a ring that cut Gisello's face. Gisello went to the doge to complain about both incidents, a lot of slapping going on, and the general perception that nobles had become very eager to slap commoners around.
So the doge brought in another commoner, who was a stonemason or maybe a sculptor named Filippo Calendario, who was working on renovations at the palace. And then together with some other commoners and some of the arsenalati and possibly Faliero's nephew, they started planning a coup. Calendario and his accomplices would recruit 20 men. Each of those men would recruit another 40. And on April 15, 1355, they would start spreading rumors that Genoa was about to attack Venice directly, hoping to cause a panic. In response to those rumors, Faliero would summon the Great Council. Once the Great Council had convened, the arsenalati would seal the exits to the council chamber, and they and those 800 recruited men would kill as many of the nobles as they could.
Marin Sanuto's account of what was to happen was slightly different. In his version, these 800 men would go make trouble all around Venice, attacking people and causing enough mayhem that the doge would ring the bells of St. Mark. That would summon the nobility to the main square, where they would then be surrounded by the 800 men and cut down where they stood.
After all this planned bloodshed was over, Faliero would appear on the balcony of the palace to speak to the people and say that all of this violence had been carried out in defense of his own life. He would call for calm and ask the popolo to recognize him as Prince of Venice. This whole plan would rid Venice of its nobility. It would install Faliero as sovereign, and then he would not have to follow all those rules and deal with all that oversight that had been put in place to restrict the power of the doge.
This plot was uncovered just before it was supposed to be carried out. A furrier named Beltramo Bergamasco visited the home of one of his wealthier customers, a man named Niccolo Leoni. Bergamasco suggested Leoni should stay home the next day. And at that, Leoni became suspicious, and when he pressed Bergamasco for details, Bergamasco told him the whole plan, including naming names. Leoni detained Bergamasco at his home, but since Bergamasco had not said anything about the doge being involved, Leone's next step was to go warn him.
So when Leoni talked to the doge, Faliero seemed to just brush this whole thing off. He already knew about it, probably didn't want him to let Leoni knew he knew. So Leoni went to the Council of Ten, which again was responsible for investigating things like treason. The Council of Ten already suspected that disaffected members of the Arsenalati might be plotting against the nobility, so the council sent some men back to Leone's home to question Bergamasco further. And then they started arresting the people that had already been implicated, including Bertucci Isarello and Filippo Calendario. The Council of Ten also summoned about 7,000 loyal men to the Piazzetta and stationed cavalry officers all around the city.
Isarello and Calendario both confessed to the plot and were sentenced to hang, and they both implicated the doge. The doge was arrested and jailed at the prison in the palace. In addition to Isarello and Calendario, at least 9 other co-conspirators were identified and hanged. And these hangings were public from the beams of the palace.
When questioned, Marino Faliero confessed to his role in this planned coup, and he was sentenced to a ritual execution. When that execution happened, he was taken to the top of the same staircase where he had given his oath of office. He was formally stripped of all of his insignias, and the corno ducale, or the horn-like hat that was traditionally worn by the doge. Then he was beheaded with a sword, with his head and his body both thrown down the stairs. That was handled before nobility, but then the palace doors were opened so the common people could come and look at the remains.
Although there were other doges who were deposed or imprisoned or charged with some kind of wrongdoing, Faliero was the only one to be executed for treason. Here is how Marin Sanuto the Younger described it. Quote, "On Friday, the 16th day of April, judgment was also given in the aforesaid Council of Ten that my lord Marino Faliero, the Duke, should have his head cut off, and that the execution should be done on the landing place of the stone staircase, where the dukes take their oath when they first enter the palace. On the following day, the 17th of April, the doors of the palace being shut, the Duke had his head cut off about the hour of noon. And the cap of estate was taken from the Duke's head before he came downstairs. When the execution was over, it is said that one of the Council of Ten went to the columns of the palace over against the place of St. Mark, and that he showed the bloody sword unto the people, crying out with a loud voice, 'The terrible doom hath fallen upon the traitor.' And the doors were opened, and the people all rushed in to see the corpse of the Duke who had been beheaded."
Petrarch visited Venice not long after all this and wrote his own account of what happened as well. Quote, "The most famous place to which his forerunners had often brought home in triumphal procession the gladdest honors, he, dragged in servile fashion by a concourse of people and stripped of the insignia of a doge, fell down a headless corpse and stained with his blood the doors of the church, the entrance of his palace, and the marble stairs, often made glorious by solemn feats or the spoils of enemies."
We can only speculate why Faliero decided to carry out this coup and then why he confessed to it. Petrarch summed it up this way, quote, "As regards the unhappy man, I am both compassionate and indignant. Honored as he was, I know not what he could have desired at the end of a long life. His misfortune is aggravated by the fact that, according to the tradition of public judgment, he will be held to have been not only miserable, but mad, and to have for so many years obtained by vain acts an undeserved reputation for wisdom. Those who are for a time doges, I would warn to study the mirror set before their eyes, that they may see in it that they are leaders, not lords, nay, not even leaders, but honored servants of the state."
Historians and commentators have put forth several interpretations of what Faliero did. Like, maybe Faliero was manipulating the popolo to try to become the supreme ruler of Venice, to put himself in charge without all those rules. Or maybe the popolo had manipulated him to try to improve their station in Venetian politics. Faliero was at least 70 when all this happened, and a few commentators have kind of written the whole thing off as a sign of age-related dementia or some other mental instability, or suggested that it was really a warped way to try to get revenge against the council for their lenient treatment of Michele Steno. Steno, by the way, was himself elected doge in 1400.
So that worked out. There is also speculation about what drove the nobility's response to this coup. The doge's questioning and execution were carried out extremely quickly, so there's been some suggestion that the nobility were using all of this as a pretense to solidify their own power and keep the doge's power in check.
In addition to being executed, Faliero was subject to damnatio memoriae, or condemnation of memory. In 1366, the Council of Ten decreed that Faliero's portrait in the palace would be painted over with azurite paint, with the inscription, quote, "Hic est locus Marini Faletri, decapitati pro criminibus." So the black banner and the inscription that are there in the Great Council Chamber today among the paintings of all the doges, those were actually put there a lot later because the chamber was almost completely destroyed by fire in 1577.
The role of Doge continued to evolve in Venice after all of this. In general, the outside world often perceived the Doge as the most powerful person of a country that was so powerful and influential that its currency, the ducat, was widely used in international trade. But although the Doge was the highest-ranking official in the Venetian government, the office's power was really limited until the end of the Republic.
Venice's power and influence started to wane in the 15th century, and various European powers united in opposition to Venice as the League of Cambrai in 1508. The Republic of Venice fell in 1797, which is a whole other story involving Napoleon Bonaparte, but part of Napoleon's rationale was that he wanted to destroy the Venetian oligarchy and democratize its government.
After the fall of the Republic, the Venetian archives became more accessible to people from other parts of Europe, and the story of this coup and Faliero's beheading became a source of fascination for various writers and artists. It is a dramatic story on its own, but it also played into perceptions of Venice as stealthy, conniving, and licentious, with a secretive government that kept its population under tight surveillance. This is pretty contrary to Venice's myths about itself as La Serenissima, or the Most Serene, a place that was blessed by St. Mark and home to a unique republic that lasted more than 1,000 years.
Yeah, as an absolute outsider to all of this, it's so interesting to me how, like, the perception of Venice in other parts of Europe historically is so different from, like, Venice's mythologizing of itself. They are almost opposite. So, in terms of all of this writing and artwork, in 1821, George Gordon Lord Byron wrote a play in verse called Marino Faliero, Doge of Venice, an historical tragedy in 5 acts. Although Byron said pretty openly that he was inspired to write this by a trip he took to Venice, there were critics at the time who interpreted it instead as a response to the Napoleonic Wars, or to the Cato Street Conspiracy, which took place a year before this play was published. We have an episode on the Cato Street Conspiracy in the archives, and we will put that out in just a bit as a Saturday classic. Gaetano Donizetti's opera Marino Faliero debuted in 1835, and then Algernon Charles Swinburne wrote a verse drama called Marino Faliero in 1885.
There were also works of art. In 1827, Eugène Delacroix finished a painting called The Execution of Marino Faliero, which seems to have drawn from both Byron's play and historical accounts of the execution, which Byron printed as an appendix. Francesco Hayez painted The Last Moments of Doge Marin Faliero in 1867.
So that is everything that I learned about this, besides the couple of sentences that were in the audio tour at the Doge's palace when we were in Venice. One of the things that's tricky to pin down about all of this is which parts of the palace are as they were when this happened, which are not many of them because there were a lot of fires and things like that, fires and earthquakes and things that destroyed parts of it. So sometimes you'll see, like, this happened at the Great Staircase. And I think the Great Staircase as it stands now, the giant staircase is what people call it. Like, I think that is a newly built structure that was after all of this. So...
so much slapping.
Yeah, there's a lot of slapping that happens in the story. And then I have other stuff. Same as when we went to Paris. We will, I'm sure, spread out our Italy-inspired episodes so that it doesn't become all Italy all the time around the podcast for a bit.
Do you have a little bit of listener mail?
I do. This is from Kathy, and this is actually about an episode that Holly researched, which was the one about accidental inventions. We talked about the microwave, and Kathy wrote, "Thank you for making life interesting and for highlighting the interesting in life. I feel like I could email a comment after every episode, but after listening to the recent Happy Accident show, I am compelled to share about one of the most amazing women I've ever known, my aunt and godmother, Audrey. Audrey was born in 1926 and was diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 8. Her medical care involved train trips from rural Pennsylvania to Cleveland, where she entered the early ranks of those being treated with insulin. While she received a medal from the Joslin Clinic for living 50 years on insulin, those were not easy years. As a young woman, Audrey earned a degree as a dietitian and worked for local hospitals. She loved to cook, she loved people, she loved. Her health declined with time, necessitating a move to a warmer climate and community with better accessibility, which she found in Tucson, Arizona. By the early 70s, Audrey's eyesight had declined significantly. One foot had been amputated as well as one leg below the knee, and arthritis had crippled her hands. Enter the microwave. While her disease and time may have ravaged her body, her spirit and wit were fully intact. This happy accident that we call the microwave allowed Audrey to safely return to one of her favorite activities, food. The microwave could be placed at the perfect height. Gone were the days of trying to maneuver the stove and oven from her wheelchair. Audrey set to work learning everything she could about microwave cooking and once again shared those loving results with family and friends. For us, the microwave may be the quickest route to a hot lunch, but for Audrey, the microwave reopened a closed door, providing a welcome pathway to independence and joy. My oldest daughter is named for her, and it is my hope that we can all live life with such tenacity and love. Thank you for indulging me this moment to remember her, Kathy. Kathy, thank you so much for this email. Number one, I love it. We talked about microwaves being a lot more affordable in that episode, but we didn't really talk about them being more accessible. And I also wanted to read this because it reminds me of my mom, who similarly, when we were kids, mom made every single thing we ate, it seemed like, from scratch. And then as she developed a disability, was less able to do that until she found ways to make the kitchen more accessible to her. And at one point, she even wrote a cookbook of all the things that she had done to try to make cooking easier and faster so that she could still do it. So thanks for, you know, sharing that story with us and also giving me a minute to just think about my mom.
Yay!
Who sometimes I still pull out that cookbook. Some of the recipes in them are things that it's honestly tough to get ingredients for now just because the types of things that are in stores now are sometimes a little bit different than they were in the 90s. So you cannot, for example, find the kind of canned ham that my mom used in a ham recipe that she made anymore. But yeah, it's a cool thing to be able to make kitchens more accessible. If you would like to send us a note about this or any other podcast, we're at historypodcast@iheartradio.com. We're also all over social media at Myths and History. That's where you'll find our Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, and Instagram. And you can subscribe to our show on the iHeartRadio app and anywhere else you like to get podcasts. Stuff You Missed in History Class is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
There's nothing worse than wearing clothes that don't fit right. That's why Tomboy X makes size and gender-inclusive underwear, swimwear, and loungewear for all bodies. Queer-founded and run for over 10 years, you can trust they know a thing or two about making the perfect pair. Feel comfortable in your own skin. Shop online today and use code IHEART for 20% off your first purchase. Only at TomboyX.com. Tomboy X. Fit for you just as you are.
Looking to part ways with complicated, expensive, and uncertain shipping? Then give your business the edge it needs with USPS Ground Advantage shipping from the United States Postal Service. Keep everything simple with clear upfront pricing and no unexpected surcharges. Keep things affordable with some of the lowest prices out there. And keep it all reliable with on-time ground shipments. It's time to turn shipping to your advantage. Learn how at usps.com/advantage. USPS Ground Advantage. Simple, affordable, reliable.
Xumo Play is your destination for endless entertainment. With a diverse lineup of 350-plus live channels, movies, and full TV series, you'll easily find something to watch right away. And the best part? It's all free. Love music? Get lost in the 90s with iHeart 90s, dance away with hip-hop beats, and more on the iHeart Radio music channels. No logins, no signups, no accounts, no hassle. So what are you waiting for? Start streaming at play.xumo.com or download from the app and Google Play stores today. All you can stream with Xumo Play.
The Toolkit Podcast is where your favorite filmmakers come to talk about their craft process.
I don't want a sloppy angle in my movie ever.
It's like being a dancer. You find the freedom in the structure.
It's where Tarantino, Gerwig, Scorsese, and Jordan Peele discuss their latest films, and showrunners take us behind the scenes of the best of TV.
Hosted by IndieWire's craft team, Toolkit is an award-winning podcast that gets at the heart of what really matters for filmmakers, like Spike Lee.
It comes back to this storytelling. What can I use in my toolbox